In January 2019, the documentary Leaving Neverland debuted at the Sundance Film Festival, and all hell broke loose. We're going to talk about it on this episode of Pop Life.
On-demand audio from WAER is made possible by contributions from listeners like you. To give or to find more information, visit our website, waer.org.
Leaving Neverland, the documentary produced and directed by Dan Reed, had its television premiere on HBO just a couple of weeks ago. It chronicles the story of Wade Robson and James Safechuck and their boyhood relationships with the biggest music star on the planet, Michael Jackson, and details the alleged sexual abuse that the two men endured from Jackson while they were 7 and 10 years old, respectively.
You know, he started talking about how much he loves me. What this is us. How we show our love for each other. The other people are ignorant and they're stupid. And they'd never understand. If they ever found out what we were doing about this sexual stuff, that he and I'd be pulled apart and that we'd never be able to see each other again. And that he and I would go to jail for the rest of our lives.
It was a gut-wrenching viewing. And to help me unpack the documentary and subsequent fallout, I welcome to the show Charisse LaPree, Assistant Professor of Communications at Syracuse University's Newhouse School of Public Communications. Her work focuses on how media affects the way we think about ourselves and our perceptions of others. She is also a self-proclaimed Michael Jackson fanatic. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Before we get started talking about the documentary itself, tell us about your fanhood. Because you went into some degree of how you really appreciated Michael Jackson, his music, your trip to Neverland.
I at the time I referred to it as my pilgrimage to Neverland after his death. I was born in 1981, right? So I won't even explain my relationship with Michael. I won't even explain my relationship with Michael. I'll just jump to his death. It's when I realized the effect that he had on me, which was when I learned of his death, I was viscerally affected. I remember it so clearly. And when I came to putting words to it, the thing that I said and I still say is that there was always a Michael dancing in my soul, and then all of a sudden one day it stopped. And it was really hard for me around the death, the funeral. I was actually in Lansing, Michigan for a conference, and on television I was watching the footage of outside the Apollo. I grew up in New York. I wanted to be there. I was watching the footage in Hollywood. I was living in LA. I wanted to be there, but I wasn't. I was in Lansing, Michigan, and I just felt separated from a culture and a community where I really wanted to immerse myself in the love for Michael. As a child, I had all the Michael records. I still do. I'm really still excited about framing them and putting them on the wall because, you know, they're historical artifacts. I danced to Michael as a child. My mother had this giant mirror in our living room. It makes the living room look bigger. So I would dance in front of it. I would play his records over and over. You know, I grew up with Michael Jackson. There was never a time in my life where there wasn't a Michael Jackson. And that all came to a screeching halt in 2009. So I feel like that probably explains, and I appreciate you using the word fanatic, especially as now that we're having these conversations, and we've had them before, I feel like we all need to reflect on our quote-unquote fanaticism.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's jump forward to the airing of Leaving Neverland on HBO, documentary that was directed and produced by Dan Reed and I guess co-produced by HBO. aired a couple of weeks ago, and there's all kinds of fallout. First, what are your thoughts on the documentary in terms of, just in general, in terms of how it was produced? From my understanding, Dan Reed doesn't have a long history in filmmaking. So from a documentary perspective, how do you think this production was done?
To be honest, I've never seen a film quite like this, primarily because, and this is something we tell our students all the time over at Newhouse, is editing short is harder than editing long. So, you know, it's 4 hours, mm-hmm. which is incredibly long. It's just interviews with these two men and their families, and you're basically just sitting down and listening to them for 4 hours with some clips of Michael here and there. And so as an media artifact, I found it to be incredibly fascinating. And I think it's really important because a lot of the backlash regarding the film, especially the phrasing from the family, is that this is character assassination. But watching it, in my opinion, Michael Jackson is a tertiary character. He is an important character as what's driving this narrative, but the primary characters are these two men. The secondary characters are their families and the way in which their families were also impacted by this phenomenon that was Michael Jackson. And I appreciate it because so much of the conversation when we're talking about sexual assault at the hands of famous people becomes a indictment on the famous person. But instead, this film was about these two men. Mm-hmm. That's it. You are here to listen to their stories. And I really appreciated that because we had a long, extended conversation with them, dialogue conversation, especially when you see the clips from Robeson from the Today Show. Like, you know, that was only 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. This is an extended 4 hour, 20 year insight into these men's lives.
I think that's a very important point because the documentary does not try to litigate whether or not Michael Jackson was innocent or guilty. It was just, here are these two individuals, here's their story. And not just, as you said, not just about their relationship with Michael Jackson, but how that their relationship impacted the family. So in one of the men's case, who was from Australia, you know, his mom picked up and moved him to America to try to have a career at the urgence of Michael Jackson. That pretty much tore the family up. The father stayed behind. The older brother stayed behind. He and his sister and mother came to California. And so you just hear the story about how their lives, how they had dreams of becoming, you know, something, in some cases dancing, in some cases performing, and how that all sort of unraveled with this connection.
And just as a side note, I'm grateful that Robeson's career is what it is, right? Like, you've heard this story multiple times that they came to try and make it and now they're struggling. And Robeson is a renowned choreographer and, you know, doing all of these amazing things. And there's just that moment where you're like, thank goodness that in the end, coming to LA, independent of Michael, coming to LA helped him move his career forward, especially when Michael cut him out. Mm-hmm. They were still able to advance and move forward. So again, seeing that narrative, it is a testament to this documentary being about Robeson and Safe Chuck and not about Michael Jackson.
Do you think, you know, like I said, we're not here to relitigate guilt or innocence, but did you find their stories credible?
I didn't find them not credible. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'll make this point that around the funeral, around the death, I was really protective of Michael Jackson's legacy. And I'll say...
So before you go on with your thought there, so you were protective of his legacy before his death.
At his death.
So, because I do want to talk about that, because this is not new information.
Right.
What we have is extremely new graphic details.
Yes.
But his relationship with young kids, the fact that he was prosecuted prior, the fact that he settled a case for $23 million. So I struggle with how we as a society sort of let that stuff pass. And I think is it because we go on this innocent until proven guilty thing?
Two things. One, I think one of the jurors in the documentary said it perfectly. I am certain that Michael Jackson has molested kids, but they could not prove beyond a reasonable doubt this case. And for me, leading up to that now, all of these stories got integrated into my head. I didn't not believe the accusers. In fact, to be honest with you, I wasn't going to watch the Leaving Neverland documentary. I have not yet watched the R. Kelly documentary. I haven't watched The Hunting Ground, that documentary that came out about sexual assault on campus. As a media scholar, sometimes you have to protect your own consciousness, right? You can't unsee these things. Mm-hmm. But I don't need to see those documentaries to know that that stuff happened. Mm-hmm. And I know that a lot of people need to see their faces, need to be immersed with these victims, need to have some kind of eye-to-eye visceral empathy for them to even believe them. I don't. Mm-hmm. So all of the women that were interviewed in the R. Kelly documentary, I believe you. Like, yeah, I don't need to sit down for 6 hours and feel your pain because I feel it mm-hmm. without having to do that. But my point is this, is that, leading up to the death and through the 90s, like I remember all of the footage. I remember all of the conversations. I remember when he was on screen talking about the raid in 1993. I remember watching the trial. Like I remember everything. And I remember thinking, this man has definitely slept with children in his bed. He's admitted to that. And I don't think that that ended well every time, if any time. I don't think that that can end well at all. But, and this is my second point, we're told to believe in the system. And I made the choice to believe in the system. Now, again, I acknowledge all of those things probably happened. It got integrated into my understanding of him. But he was shown to be not guilty. Mm-hmm. Now, admittedly, at that time, I didn't have the nuanced understanding of what it means to be a billionaire and have billionaire lawyer money. Mm-hmm. And so is it even possible that some family from some small town could compete with the epic corporation that mm-hmm. is Michael? Probably not. But nonetheless, we're told to believe in the system. This is what happened with the system. And so I smiled, nodded, integrated their stories into my understanding of him, and moved forward with his artistic contribution to culture, knowing fully well that he, much like many, many other men in power, engage in problematic behavior. I don't think I ever gave him an excuse, but to bring back to your point, I was really protective of his legacy around the funeral. Mm-hmm. So, when I would tell people I was going to the funeral at the Staples Center, someone's like, oh, he's a pedophile. And that hurt because in this moment in time where we are about to celebrate someone, you feel the need to cut down my emotion like that. Oh, he's a pedophile. Mm-hmm. Well, if I'm supposed to believe in the system, says he's not. Right. And so at least give me a week to cry a mm-hmm. little. I think when we talked about this earlier, I said, I wasn't willing to talk about the flaws in my grandfather when he died 10 right. years ago. I'm very willing now. Mm-hmm. And I think we all need to now. It is not the public's job to be protective of Michael's legacy. It is the public's job to be fully aware and cognizant of human beings, ourselves and those that we put on pedestals.
Yeah, it's not the public's job, but That's what's happening.
And how.
So we're going to get to that in just a second. I did want to – so we talked about this being a four-hour documentary, and it wasn't just the length. It was the graphic detail that in the stories that were told, which you cannot unhear.
Yes.
And I have to be honest. It was both my wife and I. Neither one of us could get to sleep for quite a long time. After viewing that, the images and imagery just playing over in your mind, it was beyond disturbing. And we couldn't sleep, and we still talked about this thing in the morning over coffee. It had that much of an impact. And, you know, it leads me to just wonder, you know, how do we process this, not just with any individual, but with one of the biggest icons in popular American culture, arguably the biggest, arguably larger than Elvis Presley, larger than the Beatles. I mean, Michael Jackson was the pinnacle of popularity,
global stardom.
And how do we? It is problematic for me as a I won't call myself a fan, but a former appreciator of his music and contributions to culture. You know, how do we reconcile all of this sort of going forward?
Well, I really appreciated the Oprah debriefing. I thought that was essential.
And that's key because I don't think a lot of people understand predatory behavior.
Yes.
And that was a very good educational moment for a lot of us.
And I think, as a debriefing, she made the point, I need you to see this part. I need you to see this part. I need you to see this part, which is really what we do in the classroom, in lecture, when we are critically analyzing an artifact. Like, you could get swept up in the Michael story, but I need you to see this grooming behavior. I need you to see the impact on the family. I need you to see the mother's pain. Like, and so I appreciated Oprah's debriefing and like sort of a post hoc lecture. To answer your question on how we resolve these things and the disturbing, gruesome, graphic nature, my immediate response is this is not about resolving the gruesome graphic nature with your ideology of Michael. This is about our ability to see sexual assault, to come back to Oprah, to see sexual assault. Everybody's, whatever the numbers are, which I believe are 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 for women, depending on the time, depending on the study, as the Oprah as the Oprah debriefing said, 1 in 6 for men, right? This is something that is everywhere, and everyone's story is graphic and gruesome. And we don't want to hear it. The same thing with the R. Kelly thing. You know, like I said, I don't want to hear it, but I believe that it is as graphic and as gruesome as the more importantly, the Robeson and Safechuck story. It is just as gruesome as any sexual assault on campus, all of them. And we need to be able to look these things in the face, and we need to be able to sit with that disgust and know that this is happening in our homes, in our churches, in our schools, everywhere. So anytime the question comes down to resolving the gruesome graphic nature with your iconography of Michael, I disagree. I think the task is to resolve the gruesome graphic nature with yourself, that we have willfully put on blinders to not see the horrible things that are happening to our children, to our adults, to our elderly. And once we continue to try, or until we stop trying to protect our psyche, ironically, because I said I didn't watch them, right? Until we stop trying to protect our psyche by ignoring what's happening, we won't move forward.
Now, before you came on to today's show, you and I had a conversation about this. You hadn't seen the documentary yet. And I asked you if you could still listen to Michael Jackson's music after the hearing it about the documentary and allegations, after having seen the documentary, I'm posing that question again. Now you said you're gonna frame the albums and but
the music.
The music itself and listening to the music, does that change for you?
I will say I haven't listened to Michael's music since the documentary was released, probably a little bit beforehand. And I can't say whether I will or will not. The music itself is deeply ingrained in my own life, independent of Michael, you know. Rocking PYT reminds me of driving down the 105 in my Honda Civic, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's there are other life components for me that the music activates. Having said that, I did use Don't Stop Till You Get Enough in lecture. Probably won't do that again. You know, when we talk about, for example, the Cosby era in television, I don't call it the Cosby era anymore. I call it the Huxtable era, that there was pre-Huxtable and there were post-Huxtables. Acknowledging that the name Cosby is a curse word, a bad word, right? So does that mean I'll never watch The Cosby Show again? No, I'll probably watch it. I will probably listen to Michael. But
when you do that, does that – how will that – so you and I – I mean, not you and I, but on this show, a mutual friend of ours, Bob Thompson and
yes.
I, keep coming back to this discussion. What do you do with the work and the contributions of people who have been either accused of or – have been proven to do horrible things? And we've kind of talked about Bill Cosby. We've talked about R. Kelly, now Michael Jackson. When you do hear the music, you hear R. Kelly song, a Michael Jackson song, Bill Cosby show comes on television, it's not the same. It's not the same as before these events happen. You're viewing, your listening experience. It's not the same. How does that change for you? And is it going to be really impactful?
Okay, two things. One, we are terrible at emotional forecasting, so I don't want to say whether it will be impactful when I get around to listening to it. But I'll make this point. I think these identities need to be integrated. So like when I said at the death, yeah, I knew that those things happened, and I just needed a moment to immerse myself and not, you know, be have that conversation just for a minute, just for one hot minute.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll make this point. The whole rhetoric now is whether we can separate the art from the artist. And I think that that is a faulty strategy. Pete Davidson has a lot of issues. But on the other side of the screening, that SNL that came after, his argument was we need to integrate both. We need to be able to see that people who made this beautiful content are also problematic. And I believe he said, you know, every time you get into a Ford Mustang, you have to shout, Henry Ford hated the Jews, right? Like, both of these things need to happen at the same time. We don't have this conversation about whether or not Woody Allen or Alfred Hitchcock or we are having Weinstein, right? But, you know, we've known about the problematic behavior of powerful people for decades. And we continue to not do that.
Mm-hmm.
So now Michael, R. Kelly, and Cosby become, can you listen to their stuff? We do not talk about, can you listen, can you watch Woody Allen? I've never seen a Woody Allen film, and I'm probably never going to.
What?
But at the moment, I know, right? I just admitted
right.
that.
Nope. That is a future show. We're going to have a Woody Allen show on Pop Life.
But on that note, Woody Allen is suing Netflix for millions because they refuse to air one of his films. They refuse to distribute it. How is that conversation getting lost? So...
Well, it's a little different for me. So, and Woody Allen is a director actor, so you do see him physically. But someone like Hitchcock, and I could be watching Rear Window, but he's not in it really. Hearing Michael Jackson's voice, and I forgot where I was just a few days ago. A song came on, and I was kind of shocked. But hearing his voice, I can no longer not think. I can't help but think Michael Jackson and 7-year-old boy. I mean, that it is among the most gruesome things, I think, that we can that can happen to a child. Again, not proven, but the accusation is there and the imagery is there. And I can no longer, I can't compartmentalize sort of my emotions and how I process things. So it does impact my ability to enjoy the art.
And I think that that is a completely valid feeling.
Yeah.
And I think that's, for some people, that feeling does not exist. I'm not going to make the assumption about how I'm going to feel.
Right.
I haven't listened to it because I'm not ready to find that out.
Right.
Let's put it that way.
Right.
And, you know, as a media scholar, I'm very protective of my media time, knowing fully well that a song can take me down a rabbit hole.
Right.
And I'll just make this point, you know, you say you can watch a Hitchcock movie and not think of his sexual assault in Tippi Hedren. I can't because I see the way in which women are treated in his films. Same thing with Quentin Tarantino. I adore Quentin Tarantino, hands down one of my favorite filmmakers. When I read that article from Uma Thurman with Maureen Dowd talking about his treatment of her, it made me revisit all of these so-called powerful women. But it really hurt for me to watch Hateful Eight and the treatment of Jennifer Jason Leigh through that entire film, where she is just consistently beaten by 7 men and then in the end lynched. I haven't been able to watch a Quentin Tarantino film since. So, you know, I hear you. I'm with you. And I'm not ready to answer that question for myself with Michael.
Right.
Although I will point out, I do have a Michael sticker on my car. It's one of the, it's the profile on the toes with the hat, and it's in the window. And I have been thinking about whether or not I'm going to take it down. Not necessarily because I feel it has different meaning, but I don't want to prompt that conversation in public with strangers.
Right.
By the same reason, I won't use Michael in the classroom anymore, because I understand that that is an impact on other people. And I am respectful of the fact that talking about Michael, playing his music, showing his image can, for millions of people, re-trigger the gruesomeness of their own sexual assault.
You know, I've not been able to find anyone in the middle. So after this has aired, there are folks that are either vehemently upset with Michael Jackson, and those that are vehemently defending the whole hashtag Michael MJ innocent movement out there. And so the fallout has been, from a social science perspective,
binary,
interesting to witness. And it gets me thinking about this, about fanaticism in general. You know, we throw the term fan around pretty loosely.
Fanboy, fangirl,
yeah.
Fanning.
But psychologically, I mean, there is something there that puts up blinders that we can't see objectively. So
right.
And this isn't just with Michael Jackson. You could take a huge football fan who has a favorite team, who one of the star players on the team knocks a woman out in an elevator on video, actual evidence, but they still defend the player and the team, and because they are afraid to let that impact their fanaticism.
I don't think it even has to be celebrity. You can talk about your local pastor.
Yeah.
Right? That it is about power. And it is about power on a large scale, which is generally our celebrity has social power, but it's power on a small scale. It's the respect, and again, to come back to the Oprah debriefing, you know, it's the respect the entire community has for this individual that puts you in a position to not be the one naysayer. Having said that, it's important to note you are never the one naysayer.
Right.
It just feels that way. And I think that was also really a powerful moment when Robeson came out and talked about it, the way in which that impacted SafeCheck. Because frankly, these stories are parallel through the documentary. They're parallel, but they're collinear, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're happening at the same time. They're the same story.
Mm-hmm.
That is when you see these stories overlap, that Robeson on the Today Show drastically impacted SafeChuck's ability to talk about, deal with, engage with his own history.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is the most important, and they say it over and over again, that is the most important piece of this documentary. It is not about a quote-unquote character assassination of Michael Jackson, but rather understanding that there are millions of children, adults, seniors to whom this has happened in different contexts, with people in power in their house, people in power in their community, the way in which institutions choose to protect individuals, to come back to the NFL, the way the institution protects the individual, regardless of the facts, the accusations, the conversation, the public secret, right? This is about our fandom, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our emotional connection to people, regardless of whether we know them or we don't, our emotional connection to people and the way that impacts our ability to integrate new information.
Yeah. And now you and I are both Black Americans, so we're going to have a little family discussion.
Yes, please.
Right now. It seems like to me, Black folk always circle the wagons around this kind of stuff. Not entirely, but for the most part. So I've been in discussions in social media within groups of folks that are just don't want to hear it at all. Just going to be very protective of Michael Jackson and others. We're very distrusting of the legal system. I couldn't even fully enjoy a comedy show the other night at the mall. Because a woman in the audience wanted to argue with the comedian about R. Kelly. It's this thing that we do, whether it's O.J. Simpson, whether it's Michael Jackson, whether it's R. Kelly, whether it's Jussie Smollett. We have this thing where we go into protection mode of the person and the legacy and their artwork, regardless of evidence. And it's fascinating to witness, but it's also frustrating for me. Am I off on that? Do you find that to be the case?
No, I am in agreement with your observations. I think it's important when it comes to any marginalized group, and we can talk about Black folks as a unique situation and the way in which their histories, especially in the United States and in the New World, colonialism has defined us, has defined the stereotype to the point where living our lives means trying to fight back against the stereotype. And there's so much negative information out there. And now you just want to take away the one thing that's good, right? This is, it's huge. On that note, I'll make this point. I remember at the funeral at Staples Center, I got interviewed by some woman. I think she was from like a Canadian news org. And she said, you know, how did you feel when the world turned against Michael? And I told her, no, you mean the white world, because the Black world kept him close. And, you know, you see that interaction at the NAACP, right? They brought him out standing ovation with the accusations and everything. So I am completely in agreement that there is this protectionist, that we have something good and we can't talk about how it's bad because everyone else is talking about how we're bad. I think it's important to not only listen to the stories of victims, but understand that when we elevate one voice, we are literally throwing away dozens of others. So to protect R. Kelly means to continue to put our girls at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not okay with that. To protect Michael Jackson, he's gone now. So it's worthwhile to have a completely different conversation. And the mother said, you know, one of the mothers said, he can't hurt any more children. I jumped up and did a little dance. But to ignore the dozens of Cosby victims and to elevate Cosby's voice is to allow him to continue this mm-hmm. predatory behavior. When we ignored or they settled the first case in 1992, 1993, it's mind-blowing that people still would allow their son or their child to be with him alone, right? Like, it's, you know, we don't want to see what's happening. And when it's in our own family, and, you know, black folks use the language of family. Mm-hmm. I don't know you. You're my brother. Mm-hmm. It's that much harder.
After having watched the documentary and after having had this conversation and considering what the artist has meant to you for a good portion of your life, how will you remember Michael Jackson?
Well, my easy answer is I don't have the answer yet. That's the easy answer. I argue I will remember Michael Jackson in the same way I have known Michael Jackson since 1992, 1993, since these first allegations broke. And that is an amazing musician with a troubled past, present, and future. And do I feel guilty over my appreciation of his music? No. I find guilt to be it has its purpose, but I find it to be a little a waste of time because I couldn't have done anything differently. Now, if I was a parent, one of those parents, that's a different level of guilt. But as a fan, as someone who appreciated the music, as someone who believed in the system, that was the, 81 to 2009, 28 years of my life. And it was what it was. Like I said, I haven't decided when, where, and how I'm going to listen to Michael again. I'm not burning his albums, although that was a really beautiful closing credits, just burning the materials and literally walking away from this traumatic piece of your childhood. But I will think twice about the way in which I engage with Michael, definitely in a public sphere, knowing fully well that there is this bipolar response. And I don't want to encourage that. I don't want to derail a conversation in the classroom because I want to play Don't Stop Till You Get Enough. I'm not that enamored to the point where I'm going to put a student through a potentially painful, triggering experience just so I can be righteous about my support for Michael. I think that we've reached a point where people are interpersonally trolling. I'm telling you that he's terrible when you love him, and I tell you I love him when you think he's terrible. Mm-hmm. That doesn't get us anywhere.
Right.
And so how do I feel about Michael today? How will I feel tomorrow? I don't know. And I'm not ready to make that decision. And luckily, I'm not in a position where my family, my future, my livelihood depends on it.
Well, when you do get there,
I'll let you know.
You'll have to come back. We'll have to chat about that.
Absolutely.
So what's up next for you? You got something going on?
Yeah. I got a lot of stuff going on. But March 28th, I will be interviewing Dana Gills, who is an executive over at Lionsgate, the director of production and development over at Newhouse. It's the 18th annual Conversation on Race and Entertainment Media. So for 18 years, Newhouse has been bringing out a prominent industry individual to talk about their experience around race. It was originally hosted by Richard Dubin, and I've been doing it for the past 5 years. And it's a really wonderful conversation. I'm incredibly proud of it because we address the intersection of industry, academia, psychology, diversity, inclusion, the problematic nature of asking people to see the world differently when that is your unique opportunity as a media, representative, media scholar, etc. So Dana will be coming out. She is part and parcel of the new Angela Davis biopic. She's been involved in the Michael B. Jordan Assassin. I think the working title is Silver Bear. And we're just going to sit down and chat about it. And I encourage all of your listeners to come out. It'll be in the Herg starting at 7 p.m. on Thursday, March 28th. And continuing conversations about race and media.
We'll put a link in the show notes for that,
well
as a link to your personal site where folks can read your blog on the passing of Michael Jackson.
Full disclosure, that was in 2009. I went back, I read it, I actively had to try not to clean things up. So your point about, you know, how will I feel about Michael, how I feel about him in 2019 is different than how I can read about him in 2009. Mm-hmm. So I hope that your readers will take this conversation and read the 2009 piece through the lens of personal psychological growth.
Right. Well, thank you for chatting with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That wraps up another Pop Life. We'll have links to Charisse's blog and other reference material on the Pop Life page at waer.org, where you can also hear past shows. Be sure to rate your listening experience on iTunes Podcast. Again, thanks for listening. I'm Joe Lee.